Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies, and we chat with its author. In her sparkling and splendid new book, The Afterlife of Ottoman Europe, Muslims in Habsburg, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Leyla Amzi Erdodolar presents a thorough and deeply layered account of the relationship between the Ottoman and Habsburg empires and Muslims of Bosnia-Herzegovina, leading to and beyond the Berlin Treaty of 1878. At the heart of Erdodolar's project is an argument for taking seriously the significant continuities in the relationship between Ottoman imperial rule and the religious and political lives of Bosnian Muslims. This meticulously researched and beautifully written book makes a compelling and convincing case for disrupting the popular opinion that locates the beginning of modernity in Bosnia-Herzegovina with the onset of Habsburg rule. It does so by showing the complex and fascinating histories and discourses on such critical questions as migration or hijra, the encounter of Islam in modernity, education, and the nation that highlight the important role and place of Bosnian Muslim intellectuals and other Bosnian actors to this story. This outstanding book is a landmark publication in the study of Islam and Muslim societies that provides a critically significant avenue of learning about a religion and history often missed in dominant historiographies. Here now is my conversation with Professor Leyla Amzi Erdodolar. Hello, Leyla. Welcome to the New Books Network. It's such a pleasure to be speaking with you, and it was such a thrilling experience intellectually, despite the conditions that we are in right now, to read this book and some very interesting resonances also, in fact, with the current moment. But as I was saying before I pressed record here, that this is such an important book for multiple reasons. Its historical rigor, the kind of wonderful lyrical prose, and just, I think, a theme and a region that so often gets missed out in discussions on Islamic studies, the Middle East, certainly modern politics. So on all these multiple fronts, I think this book makes a really exciting and important contribution. We have a tradition, Leyla, on the New Books Network, that our first question is always biographical. So could you share a bit with our listeners about your story of how you became a scholar?
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me and your kind words of introduction. I didn't always know that I will be a scholar. I came to United States with my family as a refugee during the Serbian aggression wars in the Balkans. And it is only when I was completing my master's degree that I decided to go on for a doctorate and started thinking about a career as a scholar. I was trained in Middle East studies. I did Middle East and Islamic studies, Ottoman studies, obviously, and learning Turkish and Arabic and Persian. It got me into this track. The idea for this book, of course, the book comes out of my research for my dissertation. And it really started with migration, with the question of migration, then developed into this afterlife of Ottoman Europe.
So I thought a good way to begin our conversation would be to talk about one of what I read as one of the central arguments of the book. And the book really focuses on this question of continuities in the relationship between Ottoman imperial rule and then the religious and political lives of Bosnian Muslims. So you show very clearly that there is a certain kind of a popular or even scholarly understanding of this relationship, and you provide some kind of an alternate to this popular or dominant understanding. So I was wondering if we could begin with that central argument, if you could describe that for our listeners, and that might also be a good way to, you know, set the stage, so to say, in terms of the key actors, the key sort of question that animates this book.
Sure. So Habsburg rule of Bosnia-Herzegovina is probably one of the most researched periods of Bosnian history. Very often this is presented as 1877, the year of Austro-Hungarian occupation, is presented as this entrance of Bosnia and Herzegovina into Europe, of the beginning of modernity and modernization in the province and so on. But of course, you know, scratching the surface, one can see this as rather, well, bluntly incorrect, but we see many more layers here that that overlap to give us a more nuanced picture of this period and the act of occupation and the position of this Ottoman province in Austro-Hungarian Empire. So just to mention a few, so we're talking about Austro-Hungarian occupation that was decided during the Berlin Congress in 1878 that came on the it was part of the so-called Eastern Question that the European powers saw as an important question of how to divide Ottoman territories among themselves, of course, maintaining this balance of power. So Bosnia was one of the Ottoman provinces in southeastern Europe, in sort of the Ottoman European territories. And earlier in the century, already parts of the Ottoman Empire, such as Greece or parts of Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, of course, were separated from the Ottoman domains in various different, you know, whether they're autonomous regions or independent kingdoms and so on. So there's this, a series of different arrangements for these territorial detachments from the Ottoman Empire, kind of ushered and promoted by European powers involved. In the case of Bosnia, there was in 1875 another peasant rebellion that created conditions where Austria-Hungary or the Austrian territories right across the river, so the border of Bosnia, were involved with refugee management and so on. So there was, in the eyes of European powers, ample reason to occupy this province, because the reasoning given at the Berlin Congress was that the Ottomans were unable to handle the situation in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So this province was then sort of given to Austria-Hungary to manage. And this created this ambiguity of the status of the province, which nominally still remained the sovereign possession of the Sultan, of the Ottoman Sultan, but it was effectively in practice ruled by Austria-Hungary as sort of a special unit added to the dual monarchy. And these ambiguities created space for all of these things that I talk about in the book, of the Ottoman continuities, how a local population participated in that whole story, as well as even the Austro-Hungarian administrators who in one way or another, continued some of these Ottoman features and policies and laws and practices that worked for their imperial rule in the province. Sure. So one of the main features here that we see is that Austro-Hungarian administrators continue to sort of classify and organize the population of Bosnia and Herzegovina by religion and not language, as it is in the rest of the provinces of the Habsburg Empire. Of course, this is also discounting the Tanzimat reforms that were implemented in Bosnia and Herzegovina as the Ottoman province, right? So this feature of a religion as sort of the identifying the populations was then used and abused, we could say, by all three actors, meaning the Habsburgs, the Ottomans, and the local population, and becomes this connection to the Ottoman Empire. It was a feature of the Berlin Congress and the subsequent agreement between the Ottoman Empire and Austria-Hungary that the population in Bosnia-Herzegovina, meaning mainly Muslims and Orthodox Christians, would have unimpeded connection to their spiritual leadership in Istanbul, the Sheikhul Islam, the Caliph, and of course the Orthodox Christian Patriarch. And that becomes the basis of this sort of competition among empires, and the population as well uses this as a pretext to forward their own interests in the province with both empires.
Wonderful. Lila, I want to ask one other sort of broad question before we get more into the specifics of the book and its chapters. I found it really remarkable, this one statement that you make in the introduction of the book, and you write, and I am quoting you here, you write that the history of Muslims is essential to the story of Europe, and the European Muslim experience is indispensable to the scholarly study of Muslims and Islam. It was such a powerful and important statement. I was wondering if you could just broadly speak about the importance of the statement to the larger goal of this project.
Sure. I mean, the statement really comes from this cumulative historiography that we have pretty much of the 20th century on what Europe is, what a European Muslim is, right? And who the Muslims and what kind of Islam is there in Europe. Talking about my own focus, I'd first like to say again a few set the stage for the historical circumstances. The idea of Europe to begin with, right, is being really formed in the 19th century at this time when Bosnia Herzegovina is occupied as well. So there's much work done on Eastern Europe as the East or the Orient of Europe. Southeastern Europe in 19th century was really not Europe. It was, or the Balkans, right? It wasn't Europe because it was Ottoman. And when we look at, for example, these travelers and their travelogues crossing into Ottoman territory in Bosnia, that's crossing over River Sava, it is almost as if they're, passing through a portal into this other world that is that comes from this European Orientalist imagination of the East, the Orient, with all of those features we're familiar with. So this was really the Ottoman territories, wherever they reach at different stages, were the beginning of the Orient in Southeastern Europe. And once the Ottoman territories are lost and the Ottoman border retreats, these territories are then in many a nationalist lore, then sort of reclaimed as European. And of course, there's the story of the Ottoman yoke and getting rid of the Eastern, the Asiatic Empire, et cetera, et cetera. But the consequence of this were the numerous local Muslim populations that remained behind. And these populations of Muslims were very often equated with the Ottomans. And that constant equating of Ottoman with Islamic and Turkish in these political discourses and historical discourses, of course, made these Muslim communities across the Balkans, so not only in Bosnia, but in all the other former Ottoman territories, made them alien. It stigmatized not only the religion of Islam, but also anything associated with Islamic and Ottoman architecture, language, arts, anything that was associated with the Ottoman and Islamic was deemed backward. That led to policies that scholars call de-Ottomanization, de-Islamization. And they were used not just for destroying architectural objects, but also genocide throughout the 20th century. So this denial of Ottoman and Ottoman past in the Balkans and the cultural legacy continues on to this date and is well documented in scholarship and so on. So what we ended up having in historiography is that scholars for much of the 20th century treat Southeastern European Muslims as somehow an anomaly, as a remnant of Ottoman rule, as sometimes as this romantic site of East-West encounter, right? The bridge, the symbol of the bridge, and sometimes even the bridge in Mostar in Bosnia-Herzegovina, but also as this site of the physical location of clash of civilization, as we've seen it presented, for example, by the Serbian aggressors in the 1990s. This is the stage that we're talking about in Southeastern Europe. When we talk about the Muslim world, what I wanted to show here is in the book is the activity and role and connection of Muslims, and I mostly focus on Muslims who left some written trace, right? So intellectuals and writers and so on, and activists who saw themselves as part of the broader Muslim world because of their previous connection to the Ottoman Empire and their Ottoman education and languages that they spoke that made them able to be in touch and read papers from different parts of the world, such as from the Ottoman Empire, but also from India, from Egypt. They followed the educational and institutional reorganization in the Russian Empire, Russian Muslims, those in post-Ottoman Bulgaria. So they were aware of sort of colonial situations across the Muslim world and tried to learn, in a sense, from each other about various ways that solution and advancement of their sort of cultural and political situation can be created, right? So other scholars have written about this in other locations. Faiz Ahmed calls it inter-Islamic networks and Sima Alawi Muslim cosmopolis. So what I'm doing here is really incorporating Bosnia-Herzegovina and its Muslim intellectuals into these spheres of and sort of expanding this geographic reach. and very much in response to Bosnian and Balkan Muslims being seen in contemporary studies on Islam and the Muslim world as somehow the periphery, or again, you know, from this European discourse, as some kind of an anomaly of existence in Europe.
Terrific. So in chapter one of the book, you very convincingly show and argue that, you know, Bosnia was not some kind of a peripheral or an afterthought for either the Ottoman or Habsburg empires. And you show in very interesting detail the kind of dynamics of and the ambivalences of this triangular relationship, so to say. You detail the sort of circumstances and the sort of developments preceding the eventual occupation of Bosnia by the Habsburg Empire in 1878. So could you talk about that sort of dynamic of that triangular relationship? And maybe, I mean, you talk about so many developments and historical trajectories that, of course, would be impossible to capture here. But I thought perhaps you could pick a couple of most important and major developments that you see as particularly critical to take note of in terms of period preceding 1878.
Right. So what is important to know here is, of course, the position of Bosnia-Herzegovina. This is the westernmost province of the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. Its largest border is with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. There is a history of conflict, the border conflicts, right? Bosnia is the Sarhat, the border of the empire. The Bosnian, mostly Muslims, were engaged in various defense organization of the border region in Bosnia throughout, the 18th century. So there's definitely that history of conflict and border defense of the empire. We could say pretty much on both sides. One other important thing is here to consider is, of course, Austro-Hungarian ambitions in southeastern Europe. So desire for expansion to counter Russian increasing influence in southeastern Europe. And this was something actually that both the Austrians and the Ottomans had in common to really stop this Russian expansion. So even after the occupation, we could see the Habsburgs and the Ottomans kind of collaborating more and supporting each other's aims in southeastern Europe against Russia than kind of an open conflict. Of course, all of this happened in diplomatic circles rather than on the ground. So when we talk about the actual occupation, another thing that is important to note is that this is a period when what we call the international system or international law is really being in its formative period. So occupation of Bosnia-Herzegovina by the Habsburg Empire was really one of those experimental examples, in a sense. So laws of occupation have been really tried here. At the Berlin Congress, for example, it wasn't really clear what this occupation meant. Ottomans thought that this was just going to be rather informal, but the Austro-Hungarian troops were there before it was even ratified, was kind of upsetting to the Ottomans as well. So troops on the ground was something that what the Austrians understood this occupation to be, right? So we have these different ideas of what occupation means. And throughout the decades that the Habsburgs controlled Bosnia-Herzegovina, this was sort of a point of contention and experimentations with both empires. How far can we go in defining what this occupation means? And of course, in between 1908, there's the Young Turk Revolution in the Ottoman Empire, and this is a cue for the Habsburgs to annex Bosnia-Herzegovina from the Ottoman Empire, knowing that they won't be able to react in the midst of revolution. So this is sort of the formal annexation, whereas the previous decades were really an experimentation in the laws of occupation and what occupation of a sovereign land meant in international law. So what we see when, and just one more point I want to make here is, why is this relevant? Well, how was it different from anything else we've seen in that region and in the way that the Ottoman territories were chipped off in a sense in their European land possessions. So what was important here is that Muslims had a very different experience than in the rest of Southeastern Europe. So what the Habsburg occupation of Bosnia, how it was markedly different, was that despite this history of conflict and in 17th century and late 17th, 18th century, the Habsburg administrators saw the Muslim population as crucial to establishing their rule in the province. What happened with the Ottoman withdrawal from Eastern Europe since the late 17th century was concurrent with de-Islamization of the people, regions, even names of places, right? So that this method became so consistent and so common that it's still something that's not really discussed by scholars a lot. It's a practice that was expected, and it wasn't considered for its consequences, which is de-Islamization, right? So when the Habsburgs enter Bosnia Herzegovina, the Muslim population was protected by the incoming administration. It was considered important for their plan in the province. And while there are other territories like Bulgaria and other parts of Ottoman Europe other states were being carved out of the Ottoman territories, the experience of Muslims there was very different. The experience in post-Ottoman Greece, Serbia, Romania, Bulgaria, even after wartime violence that targeted Muslims, of course, the remaining Muslims continued to be victims of policies that were meant to exclude them and expel them from these new nation states. The idea was to make these new nation state ethnically, religiously uniform, which in turn solidifies that particular nation's claim to land. So in a sense, we could say that after the separation from the Ottoman Empire, Bosnia-Herzegovina was able to preserve its religious and ethnic diversity, and specifically its Muslim population, precisely because of Habsburg rule. The Habsburgs hoped that Muslims will sort of disengage from the Ottoman Empire and then see the Habsburg Emperor as sort of the protector of their interests. This, in turn, was also an effort to show that the model that Austria-Hungary had, this multicultural model, worked. So they had their own sort of internal reasons wanted to show the rest of European colonial powers that they too can achieve this and are capable of running an Ottoman province in their sort of different way.
The next two questions I want to ask are about that central theme you were talking about of migration, which is also a major theme in the middle of the book. And you know, before I ask my question, I found it really moving, the narrative, and it's so resonant to the present with which you begin your chapter on Hijrat or migration, where you talk about the migration of Bosnian Muslims to Palestine under Ottoman rule at that time, who founded, relocated to Qaisariya, and how, you know, in 1948, then they again had to be uprooted through Zionist colonialism. So I found that a really, really moving narrative with which you began. The question I want to ask is, you show and you really detail the varied forms of motivations and the impetus for this migration of Bosnian Muslims to Ottoman, you know, domains of control. So if you could share a bit with our listeners about, you know, what were some of the key motivations that animated this migration, and how did these migrations test the political and the administrative capacities of the Ottoman state?
Yeah, so this nicely ties into this what I was just talking about, the Austro-Hungarian model, imperial model that they tried to test and showcase in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So they really wanted to show that their inclusive imperial model is successful, especially in the midst of nationalist and pan-nationalist movements that were threatening this model in the Habsburg Empire, in this multicultural, multilingual empire, which was in that sense similar to what the Ottomans were doing. Muslims in Bosnia, a number of them, like the case that you just mentioned, left before the occupation even took place. Those were mostly people who could leave, who had the funds to leave, and were able to establish themselves in the Ottoman Empire with the permission of the Ottoman Empire. A number of people who leave at the onset of the occupation were administrators and bureaucrats of the Ottoman, associated with the Ottoman administration there, people who serve in the military and so on. And then there are several events throughout the Habsburg period in Bosnia and Herzegovina that were sort of the events that prompted larger scale migration. So in 1882, a conscription law was issued, and many people who didn't want to serve in the Habsburg military or didn't want their children to serve in the Habsburg military decide to leave. Austro-Hungarian authorities, of course, don't want this to happen. But they were also interested in establishing conscription throughout the province. So there was definitely that tension there that died down very soon. There was also an armed rebellion in reaction to conscription and so on. Another event is, of course, the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina by Austria-Hungary in 1908 and the subsequent agreement in 1909 that kind of sealed the fate of Bosnia as Austro-Hungarian domain. So until then, some people thought that there's still some chance that because legally it was a sovereign territory of the Ottoman Sultan, Bosnia might somehow revert to Ottoman control at some point. But of course, as the years went on, this became more and more of a wishful thinking than any kind of reality. Although there were people who thought that maybe young Turks would be the ones to reclaim the lost territories in Europe and so on. So what is important here is also that a lot of misinformation circulated about the position of people, about alienation of their possession, land and possessions, because this was something that was happening in other regions in Ottoman Europe when the Ottomans withdrew. People were dispossessed, expelled, and so on. So even after these decades, some rumors about these kind of possibilities circulated. So that encouraged another wave of migration. A lot of this migration had underlying sort of less social but economic circumstances. So with the onset of Austro-Hungarian rule, Bosnia was incorporated into the Austro-Hungarian markets, and which made Bosnian merchants and artisans, it made it hard for them to compete. Taxes changed that, especially in the early years of occupation, were impossible for some to come up with. So there was a lot of such cases that I described that that prompted people to decide to go on to the Ottoman Empire. What they ended up doing is a lot of them, especially at the time of occupation and conscription, is go to nearby territories from where they in the Ottoman Empire, because at this point the border of Bosnia, the southeastern border, is with the Ottoman Empire. So they would cross into the Ottoman territories, kind of waiting for things to change in order to come back. So much of this migration in the early period was really not permanent migration. They expected to be able to return to their homes. Some continued relationships with, sort of live in the Ottoman territory, but have properties and businesses go on in Bosnia. So there's definitely these family, trade, and other business relationships that continued that allowed for populations to kind of come and go and have an idea what they can do in the Ottoman Empire, how they can move and prepare for the move, which wasn't the case, for example, for other refugees that were coming from other parts of southeastern Europe or from Russia, Crimea and the Caucasus and so on. So the Bosnian experience of migration was very different than the rest of the 5 to 7 million people who come to the Ottoman Empire in its last century. And of course, it was much smaller in number. It was a larger number for Bosnia as the province, but in as a percentage of Ottoman migrants, so immigrants that come into the Ottoman Empire, they were in a much smaller percentage.
The next question I want to ask is about this fascinating chapter, one of my favorite chapters, I think, in the book. All of them are wonderful. Where you really bring to light some of the sort of internal debates and differences of opinion on the very question of the normative Islamic status of Bosnia-Herzegovina, the question of is it Darul Islam, Darul Harb, etc., and on this very question of Muslim migration from there to Muslim majority territories or to Russia. So I was wondering if you could maybe take a couple of these examples of discussions, discourses, and arguments on this twin question of the normative Islamic status of Bosnia-Herzegovina and on the whole question of is migration obligatory or not and so on. And what was at stake in these competing positions that were taken on this issue?
Yes, so this question of status of Muslims under non-Muslim rule starts to be discussed among Islamic scholars, intellectuals. It's in the papers. Fatwas are being published all around. And of course, this wasn't a question for Muslims in Bosnia and Herzegovina only, but it was discussed in places as far as India and the Russian Russian Central Asia and so on. So, excuse me. But also, this was not a new new question, right? The Islamic scholars have discussed this before because this is not the, the very first time that Muslims live under non-Muslim rule. What first comes to mind is, of course, Al-Andalus, where Muslims, where these kinds of discussions and scholarly work was also produced on the status of Muslims under non-Muslim rule. And then throughout history, we have other examples of this. But what was new in 19th century is that so many Muslims were under colonial rule in their native lands, and discussions about whether Muslims should migrate and make hijrah, right, making this connection to the hijrah of the Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina, to live under to live in freedom, right, under Muslim rule and live. A phrase often mentioned is live an Islamic life, right? So we're at this point, really, in 19th century, we're talking about millions and millions of people. And much of this discussion, and so the majority of opinions, we could say, is really not about encouraging migration. Yes, there are scholars sort of writing fatwas and opinions about Muslims needing to migrate. And one of the places, of course, is the Ottoman Empire. It's the last sort of sovereign Muslim-ruled country. The discourse really includes discussions of Islamic scholarship and previous opinions and so on. And as you mentioned, the notion of Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Islam. But what many sort of religious scholars, but also intellectuals, grapple with is the actual possibility of doing such a large-scale migration, what it means for those who can't make migration, who can't leave and will be left as even weaker communities, all right? And this is the question in Russia. This is the question in the Balkans as well. So in Bosnia and Herzegovina, we have early on opinions by religious scholars. So treaties discussing this. Discussing this idea of needing to whether Muslims should emigrate to the Ottoman Empire because the new administrative authority in their province is non-Muslim, and they're very clear on that the answer is no, that they shouldn't. What you know through you know scholarly analysis, they prove that. Leaving is only contributing to losing this land and weakening the community. And some scholars who even, you know, don't write it in terms of in a shape of a fatwa or a religious treaty, they decide to publish this in papers, right? So newspapers and print. Is really a much broad, has a much broader reach, and they write this in the language of that appeals to Muslims, but they're not sort of treaties format or fatwa format, but discuss this sometimes even with. Theorizing on their national identity and unity and so on, and bringing in some of this sort of Islamic rhetoric into these appeals to wider public not to leave their country, their provinces, lands, and countries, right? So, of course, there are people who are advocating for migration. But as I mentioned, much of the migration is really not about being somehow pressured not to practice Islam, which many of these scholars find is not the case in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But as I said, they're economic and sociopolitical and so on. So yeah, there's this broader discussion of what should Muslims do when they're under non-Muslim rule. And Bosnian Muslim scholars plug into these broader discussions with their opinions on the migration. Of course, there's other other interests here involved. It's not only religious reasoning. There's political. There's the Ottoman state that also does not encourage migration from this province that is, again, still nominally Ottoman. So emptying it out of its Muslim would lessen the Ottoman claim to the province. There are other, you know, reasons of financial support for such a big move, or how the Ottoman states would care and facilitate the actual move and care for the migrants once they come there. And what is important to know here is that the Ottoman Empire is already dealing with waves of migrants from Bulgaria and the Caucasus, who are constantly arriving, and we're talking about millions of people arriving in the Ottoman Empire. So for the Ottomans, this was not, despite the Sultan Abdulhamid II's pan-Islamic rhetoric, this was not something that the Ottomans really encouraged.
So I mean, there is so much to talk about in this deeply layered book, but I wanted to come back to a broader question with which you end the book, and the epilogue is itself a substantial chapter in and of itself, which I think would be of particular interest to, you know, scholars of Islam, who are the primary sort of listeners to this podcast, although it, you know, travels widely in all kinds of domains. The main argument that you make in this book, which is very convincing and compelling, is, as you were speaking at the beginning of our conversation as well, dispelling this notion that equates the onset of modernity in Bosnia-Herzegovina with the onset of Habsburg rule. But in the epilogue, you again, you know, make this argument by actually showing ways in which some very interesting but maybe less known Bosnian Muslim intellectuals in the Western historiography, at least, how they articulated particular visions of Islam, of particular visions of reforming Islam, that were premised on specific understandings of both modernity and its relationship to Islam. So really, you show very convincingly the depth and the complexity of these Muslim modernist and reformist voices that were doing some very creative and interesting work that gets ignored if one just equates modernity with, you know, the onset of Europe. So I was wondering if you could perhaps take a couple of examples of these figures and scholars and describe a bit their vision of Islam and their understanding of the relationship between Islam and modernity.
Sure. So when we talk about modernity and what is often associated with it, modernization, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, we're really talking about the Ottoman period, 19th century, of course, the Tanzimat reforms. Bosnia and Herzegovina become one of the pilot provinces for reforms in the Ottoman Empire in the 1860s with some significant success. So the printing press, the local press in local language in Bosnian, so representative councils, modern schools for teachers, military school, and sort of the educational reform all really start with these Ottoman reforms in the middle of the 19th century. After the the Habsburg occupation. The Habsburgs, of course, continue on with whatever is there in terms of institutions and laws, and so their approach is to change it gradually as the options become available. We do have continuation of many of these schools and educational systems, and just like in the Ottoman Empire, we could say with the establishment of parallel sort of institutions of Habsburg education. So the inhabitants of the province really have access to all of these different modes, and they also go on for education in the Ottoman Empire, in the modern universities and schools of the Ottoman Empire, mostly in Istanbul, but also other capitals of the Ottoman Empire. So when we look at this turn of the 20th century reform movement among Muslim intellectuals in Bosnia, we could say that it's really an outcome of the encounter with modernity in the context of the Ottoman as well as Habsburg imperial policies, and then the intellectual currents that extend across the Middle East and Eurasia because of the availability of much improved communication, interconnected market, travel, print, of course. So this circulation of information, availability or ease of travel with steamship technologies, railroads, and so on. And another thing that I actually write about in this last chapter, new forms of associational life, all enabled Bosnian Muslim intellectuals to see themselves as part of overlapping global community of Muslims that were conversing through the press, as Slavs, which they were situated in southeastern Europe and speaking and publishing in Bosnian language, which is a Slavic language. And, coming from the material that they wrote, they saw themselves as citizens of the civilized world, right? This comes up often in what is written when they're seeking their rights, that we are citizens of the civilized world. And on top of all of that, they see themselves as subjects or citizens of both Habsburg and the Ottoman empires. So what I try to do is reconstruct or partially reconstruct this milieu in which that is really in the juncture of what is often considered something contradictory, that European tracks or Ottoman, Balkan, Eastern European, Muslim intellectual domains, these were very often or are very often studied as something separate, is studied in sort of their own circle. But what we have here in Bosnia-Herzegovina is really an overlap, a juncture of all of these different spheres or tracks. This overlap is, of course, doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's mediated, right? So we have the imperial environments, Ottoman and Habsburg, but also national movements and pan movements, right? Pan-Slavic, but also pan-Islamic and so on, that shaped how this modernity is understood and sort of internalized. So what I call it alternative modernity. So it's not some modernity that what in historiography we often see is modernity that comes from Europe, that is implemented by way of Europe, that is Europeanized. But what I see it is an alternative that is developed when these intellectuals are able to use the potentials of this overlapping and intersecting environments, no matter how they are limited by these imperial or national environments. So when we talk about modernization and the idea of modernity in the context of Bosnia, the fact that it started in the Ottoman Empire, and in the Ottoman Empire it wasn't an Islamic project, right? It was articulated in an Islamic framework. It did not. The Bosnian Muslim intellectuals did not encounter it as a European project, right? So once the Austro-Hungarian policies of, you know, modernizing institutions and the province and the education system and so on commence, they're not really seen as something alien and foreign. They're really a continuation of Ottoman projects started in sort of the middle of the 19th century. And the intellectuals and the modernists of the time, they continue to interpret this approach to modernity and to modernization, which they see as very connected, through Islamic discourse, even when they're not necessarily Islamic scholars. To mention different people, I think the most famous is a person who becomes Reis ul-Ulema of Bosnia-Herzegovina, Cemaluddin Çavuşević, an Istanbul educated reformer who actually continues his work through the Habsburg period, but also the interwar period in what later becomes Kingdom of Yugoslavia. So one could really trace this his intellectual legacy across these empires, in a sense. What is sort of in the when we think of, excuse me, when we think of sort of the bigger picture, or see this period in hindsight, what really comes out is that this experience of the Habsburg, the Ottoman and Habsburg experience, and the articulation of modernity, of a Muslim modernity, is a really important basis or foundation for later, for dealing with later challenges in the 20th century for Muslims in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Challenges that were very much a part of the new sort of political political organization, the new states that they became part of, and later on in, during World War II and afterwards in the socialist Yugoslavia as well.
So I know this might seem like a unfair question after a book that you've just finished and which is so multi-layered and such a thorough and fascinating history, but I was wondering if you could share with a bit with our listeners about what might be the next project that you're working on.
Oh yes, I already started doing some research for the next project, and the next project deals actually with migration of Muslims from sort of looking at the broader migration from Southeastern Europe, from the Balkans into the Ottoman Empire at the turn of the 20th century. So the period is a bit broader and goes into the migrations of Muslims on a larger scale continue into the 1950s. So I'm looking at this sort of broader period of more or less continuous migration of Muslims from the Balkans, even when the Ottoman Empire ceased to exist.
The Afterlife of Ottoman Europe, Muslims in Habsburg, Bosnia-Herzegovina, by Professor Leyla Amzi Erdodolar, published by Stanford University Press in 2023. Thank you so much, Leyla, for your time, for these wonderful and detailed responses here. I'm sure our listeners will really benefit from this conversation. And of course, for writing this really brilliant and important new book. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
So this was my conversation with Professor Leyla Amzi Erdodolar on her wonderful and fascinating new book. I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network, that is NBN. And I hope you will also join us next time for another fresh episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to NBIS, New Books in Islamic Studies.